It's about amending and fixing capitalism. It's a human-made system in the service of humans. If it doesn't work, fix it. I can even quote Tucker Carlson on that. He said, capitalism is a tool, like a staple gun or a toaster. If it's broken, fix it or get another one. And I'm here to say we need to fix it.
The Global Business School Network welcomes you to The Global Exchange, a podcast series featuring conversations that matter for management education, societal development, and the communities we serve. I'm Dan LeClaire, CEO of the Global Business School Network. Today, we're thrilled to have Andrew J. Huffman as our special guest. He's the Halston Professor of Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan, and something that we always like to emphasize, I think is especially worth emphasizing, that's a position that holds a joint appointment between the Roth School of Business and the School for Environment and Sustainability. Welcome, Andy.
It's great to be here, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, we're thrilled. I'm thrilled. This is the second time we've had a conversation like this, and I think that's a reflection of what I told you before everybody joined, that I've read three of your books. I can't say that about too many people. I don't read as much as I used to, but I got the Engaged Scholar, and I have Management as a College, and most recently, not that long ago, just a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Business School and the Noble Purpose of the Market. As you can see from these books there, I really did read them. The sticky notes, I think I like to offer as proof that I read them. And, you know, I want to say congratulations first, but also thank you. I often tell people when they ask, I don't usually volunteer, what do I do? And I tell them I work with business schools, and then they kind of change the subject quietly. But it's not the sexiest topic to write about, but you've written these three, probably others that I haven't read, books about business schools and about management education. I feel like you're writing them for me. So thank you.
That's really nice here, actually.
Yeah, well, I hope your sales reflect otherwise, but I feel like you're writing them for me. This is great. And by the way, I should note that as I prepared for this, I decided I'm going to read a fourth Andy Huffman book, and it's called The Builder's Apprentice. I saw that on your list, and I said, that's got to be an interesting book. And so look forward to perhaps talking with you about that one day, perhaps on the side. But I want to start by confessing something. I should confess, and I do so after reading your book, that I've overestimated the positive progress we've made in business schools. You know, I speak a lot about business schools, and I've been, over the last several years, saying that we've made such great progress in business education and moving the needle towards more positive impact on society. And after reading your book, I feel like I need to back off of that a little bit. And I didn't have to go further than the preface to feel that way. And when you wrote about in the preface why you wrote this book now, perhaps you could just share. I boil it down to three reasons, two related, and then the third more about your personal position where you are in your career.
Well, I mean, when you think about the progress in business schools, there's actually two components here. What kind of changes happened in business schools, and then how have the issues evolved? Back in when I got my PhD in 1995, I knocked on doors at the business school for professors to be on my committee. And for the most part, they said, what are you doing there? It's nothing to do with business. Go to a school of government. That's where they focus on environmental issues. And in 1997, after a postdoc, when I interviewed for a position at a top-tier business school, I was told, we really love your stuff on organizational theory, but we think you're too focused on the environment. So that's where we were when I started. And today, that is not the case. Today, the environment is a legitimate topic in our research journals. It's a legitimate topic in courses. But at the same time, the issue has evolved. Climate change is a systems breakdown. It's not an environmental issue. Income inequality is a systems breakdown. It's built into the system. Both of these are not externalities. These are not unintended consequences. They're the product of the system as designed. In the preface, I just point out that when I started to make environmental issues legitimate, I would just integrate them into business language and say quite explicitly, you don't even need to believe in climate change. All you need to recognize is that your consumers, your banks, your insurance companies, your competitors, they care about this. Your market is shifting, adapt. And I've come to realize that while that's expedient in the short term, something is lost. The true depth of these issues is missing. And so rather than fitting climate change, income inequality into a system that is causing these problems, we need to rethink the system. We all have our zone of influence. Mine is business education. And so I want business education to rethink the system. I'm not advocating for socialism. That S word may not be as problematic in other parts of the world than the United States. Like when I first presented this at the Harvard Business School, where I did the fellowship to write it, that was one of the first questions. Is this going to be an attack on capitalism and an advocation for socialism? It's about amending and fixing capitalism. It's a human-made system in the service of humans. If it doesn't work, fix it. I can even quote Tucker Carlson on that. He said, capitalism is a tool, like a staple gun or a toaster. If it's broken, fix it or get another one. And I'm here to say we need to fix it. And that means adjusting the curriculum. The idea of having a course on climate change and dropping it into a curriculum that says that government has a limited role in the market. The shareholder is all that matters. People are inherently selfish. Efficiency is always good. It won't work. Same with income inequality. And I would add one last thing. One I'm writing about is the variant of capitalism we have in the Western world right now, which is shareholder capitalism. It's actually not performing economically as intended as well. I mean, CEO pay over this period of time of shareholder capitalism has gone up faster than corporate profits, which is quite ironic since the whole idea of shareholder capitalism was supposed to align the interests of the principal and the agent, and the agent is doing quite well. In this strange world, average workers are getting the short end of that stick.
Yeah, well, perhaps we won't spend as much time unpacking some of those issues as understanding the way forward in this conversation. But, you know, I think the way you've unpacked some of this and the way you frame that, even initially in the preface, you know, that which to me is a combination of two things, right? It's this sort of understanding about the limitations of how we've approached this topic in business schools, right? Trying to shape climate action into a system or push it into a system that we know, rather than reshaping the system to meet our needs. Oversimplifying,
In business schools, we teach students, you always have to make the business case. You can't do anything without making the business case. And that takes away judgment, character, wisdom. And we could be talking about climate change. We could also be talking about, for example, you can become the CEO of a company and you can realize that women are paid 85 cents on the dollar of men. If you're only going to fix it, if it makes money for the company, you won't fix it. Because guess what? It costs money to equalize the salaries. Right. You can try and make the case, well, we'll have a more diverse workforce, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, it's not going to, you have to do something because it's just the right thing to do. And we take that away from students. And I'm finding students starting to push back and saying, I do not want to check my values at the door when I walk into the business school. I want to take the whole person into this education. And I think we should respond.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Because I, you know, even coming into this call, even as much as 10 minutes ago, I didn't know exactly where to take the conversation. But one of the things that surprised me about the book, you know, when I've read a lot of books about business schools, and they almost never start with the student. And what is it, chapter two? I mean, you chapter two, which right after what amounts to an introductory chapter, you get right into the implications for students. And I thought that was interesting and unusual for the kinds of things that we do. Why did you start there?
Well, isn't it ironic that a business school professor writing for his students is unusual. The irony of that is just amazing to me, because you're absolutely right. My reward system is for academic publications, which are designed to reach other academics on issues, by the way, that are driven by the A-level journals, which are driven by theory and therefore become increasingly disconnected from the real world. So the biggest impact we have as professors is not our academic publications. When I come to the end of my days and look back, it's not going to be my citation counts and my H index. It's going to give me a satisfaction of a life well lived. It's going to be the students that I touch, and that will be my legacy. And so I wrote this for students. I want students to be our future leaders. I get frustrated when I hear faculty give talks on climate change and things like that. And the question inevitably comes up, are you optimistic? I hear it all the time. And they say, yes, I'm optimistic because the next generation is going to solve these problems. And then my follow-up question is, and what are you going to do to help them do that? Because we're not equipping them with the skills and the broader development of judgment and character. That course, Management, the book you have, Management as a Calling, I developed a course called Management as a Calling. I could only have done it with outside funding. I got a grant from the Arthur Anning Davis Foundations, and I was able to do it. I could not have done it with internal resources, which speaks to the hesitancy of doing this. And I take students on retreat out in the woods, take away their cell phones and their computers, and I guide them a process of discerning their calling in management. When I tried to get course credit the first time, I was turned down, where the head of the curriculum committee actually said to me, this seems more developmental than academic. And I laughed at him. I said, yeah, and we should do more of it. And so I do find that faculty are putting on these blinders that the only thing that matters is my A-level publications. Teaching is a secondary issue. If you look in 2022, the keynote address at the ACSB Dean's Meeting was done by Sidney Finkelstein at Tuck, and under the title, Are Business Schools a Scam? I mean, we demote teaching. It's a teaching load. The most important thing is research for other professors. So if we're not writing for business people and we're not writing students, who are we writing for? What are we doing? And so your question gets to that. It should be our students, and it should be the practice of business. We are a professional student school. We should focus on the profession, and yet we don't.
Wow, I didn't expect all of that so quickly in this conversation, but there it is. And in fact, I think a lot of what you brought up will come up again in different ways, not just in relationship to what the implications are for students. But before we leave the topic of the students, what really resonated was this idea that students need to take charge of their education. You know, it's something that I've felt is being driven in many ways by lots of things, not just what you're concerned about, but even technology, right? That's providing the tools to enable students to take charge or take responsibility, create their own pathways, so to speak. And yet even there, I think there's some resistance amongst faculty and administrators that think they know what's best for the student. But I didn't want to pass up the opportunity to let you talk about how important it is for students to have that kind of opportunity, right? Yeah. They're dropped into this, notwithstanding what Gabriel says, some business schools are standalone. Right. But especially in a place like University of Michigan.
Yeah. I mean, your students are dropped into a resource rich environment. So here at the University of Michigan, we have 17 schools. And if students never leave the confines of the business school and go over to the School of Public Policy, engineering, School for Environment, political science, they're missing out on diversifying their education. The chapter on students has three components. It says three things for students. One, business schools are broken. And we can debate that, because that comment gets people upset. Andrew Carolli has an endorsement on the back of the book, and I'm very proud that it's there, because endorsements now, this is the greatest book, you should buy it, blah, blah, blah. And Andrew Carolli, the dean at Cornell, his endorsement is, there's as much with which I disagree, sometimes strongly, as with which I agree on this book. But it will change your priors as it did mine. We need to have this discussion now. That's my point. I want to have a discussion. And so to have a discussion, you have to push. And so I'm pushing. Business schools are broken, number one. Two, go anyway. The power you have in business to make a difference in the world, to realize your calling, to have the legacy you want is enormous. But then three, take control of your education. So yes, there are 17 schools. Get out there. But even if you don't have those 17 schools, within the confines of the business school, knock on professors' doors. I'm amazed how few students do that. Do an independent study, organize a conference, organize a panel discussion, organize a webinar. You have an opportunity in any kind of educational environment to improvise. And if you just take the curriculum as given and do nothing else, you're going to get a modicum of education. And that leads towards what I see in our students, that the most important thing they want is the credential. If we are merely access to a network, if that's our primary value, That's a very dangerous place to be, because once people figure out another way into that network, we're done. And so I think that especially at this time when things are in turmoil, we should be taking the opportunity to start to rethink the curriculum and rethink our purpose as business schools.
Yeah, I'm going to, well, let's do this. The next chapter after the students deals with the implications for faculty. And there's this point about being an elder that I want to come back to perhaps, because I think in some ways that's where we started in thinking about why you wrote this book. But I'm going to skip towards the end of the book, chapter 11, because I'm not Andrew Karolyi, right? Mm-hmm. But I want to explore a couple of what I think are very difficult topics in the work that we do at the Global Business School Network. And you have ideas about how we approach those topics and what we can do, but I think they're particularly challenging. Mm-hmm. One is trade. One is international trade. Mm-hmm. And the second one I want to talk about is growth. Mm-hmm. And these two are, as you point out, one of those things that become fundamental in business schools in some ways by default almost. We don't even think about it, but it's built in. And let me frame the question that I haven't been able to figure out on my own. So the first one, trade. I was once in a presentation with the CEO, the new CEO, fairly new now, of DHL. His name's Tobias Mayer, if I recall correctly. And he said something like this, maybe not in these words, but there's no way we could address climate change meaningfully without free trade. That's what he said. I've been trying to unpack that, right? Trying to understand exactly what that means. What do we do about something? And Gabrielle, if I remember your work with AACSB at the time when we started working, it was about globalization of management education. Help us to unpack this particular topic a little bit, if you will. If you don't want to, that's okay as well. We can come back and lead into it. But
well, you're keying in on chapter 11, and that's hooked on Sumatra Ghoshal's compelling point that bad management theories are destroying good management practice. So I'm advocating for a redefining of the curriculum. And part of that has to be starting to look and say, are the things that we're teaching that are actually getting in the way? And so the idea of free trade is important, but has it been unquestioned? I think that the MAGA voter right now is driven in part by saying, wait a minute, you can think that it's going to be more efficient to move manufacturing to another country, but what about those people left behind? That is not even in your equation. And that's true. Angus Deaton's recent book, Economics in America, just rips the field for saying economics used to be based in moral philosophy. And you can just talk about money, but these are people's lives we're talking about, and that has to be factored in. And so how do we think about global trade, the Ricardian model? Does that apply to everything? I do have a little bit in there about Larry Summers' infamous memo at the World Bank saying, does it make sense to send polluting industries to developing countries? And he laid out a very cold economic analysis that, yes, it does. And he got rightly eviscerated for this. And he was saying, He did a mea culpa and said, I'm just trying to point out what economics does. We can take him at his word for that. But the values embedded within the business education would actually support that idea that, you know, people in developing countries, they don't live as long. So it's not going to hurt them as bad. They're at the beginning of the Kuznets curve. They want economic growth more than they want pollution to a clean environment. Oh, really? Is it that simple? And so just bringing in these questions, again, it's coming down to wisdom. And we teach things as professed truths. And we should allow students some time to examine, to interrogate these ideas, especially in a world that is increasingly flat. And our students are much more aware of the issues around them, more than just, if it makes money for the shareholder, that's what I'm going to do.
Well, I appreciate that response. And I think that's a reflection on how you approach the rest of the book as well. So it's this lens through which we view topics in business schools, largely through the economics lens. But if you begin to think about them through other lens, environmental lens, the humanitarian or humanistic lens, you know, all of those things, you begin to discover that there's so much richness that you've
When I hear a student use the preamble, speaking as a business person, I stop them. I say, wait. You're a human being. Why are you cleaving out all those dimensions of who you are and just saying, as a business person, this is what we're going to do? You got to keep the whole person there.
Well, I want to ask the second question, because I don't necessarily believe the response is the same when it comes to the question of growth, right? So underlying a lot of what we talk about, I mean, every business case discussion starts with the often unsaid, but the idea that our goal is to grow in some way, right? Yeah. But let me just frame it by saying that I was in South Africa during the last election, not because of the election, but during the last election, and gave me the opportunity to explore from the ground in some ways the issues, never quite completely as I'd like. But by the time I left South Africa, I realized that the challenges that South Africa faces aren't solvable without economic growth. Right. Yeah. You can't have nearly 50% unemployment amongst young people. That's a big problem and an important problem to solve, but you can't solve it without economic growth. I just couldn't figure that out. But yet, as you've correctly pointed out in the book, that this is one of those fundamentals revolving around what business schools do that needs to be questioned, rightfully. I believe it. But this tension between what the world needs, especially the global South, if you will, low and middle income countries, and what the other needs, I guess, of society are, is really important.
You know, and once again, I think there's two components to what you're saying. First is, when it comes to growth, we just want more. Just unquestioned, we want more, whatever it is, more. And as measured primarily by GDP, and GDP just measures the movement of money, whether it's good or bad, it doesn't show up. It's a little snarky, but I say I'll start every day eating Krispy Kreme donuts for breakfast and McDonald's for lunch and Burger King for dinner, and GDP goes up. Then I have a heart attack and go to the hospital and GDP goes up. And then I die and my family has a funeral for me and GDP goes up once again. Even the economists who developed GDP said, do not use this as an aggregate measure of national economic health. There are other measures that matter, but this obsession with GDP ignores a whole lot of other things. So I teach a course called Reexamining Capitalism, and one of them is, let's look at capitalisms around the world. There are many ways to do this, and that's a revelation in itself to them. And then I really point out, okay, America's number one. We have the largest GDP in the world. Great. Where are we on the Gini coefficient? Oh, we're 121. Oh, maybe that's important. Then let's start to look at Denmark or Norway or Sweden. GDP isn't as high, but Gini coefficient is much lower. There are other metrics that we should use to think about what is our objective in the economy. And then start to just, again, interrogate these issues. There's really strong thinking that in a developed economy like the United States, a slowing of GDP as a metric actually makes sense. As we get older, I spend my money on services, and that doesn't show up as strongly as manufacturing and GDP, yet it's still there. It shows that we have advanced, and don't freak out. And then how do we bring in a serious discussion about things like decoupling? Can we have economic GDP growth that's not connected to increases in the energy use or material use? Can we have green growth? Can we have steady state growth? Can we have degrowth? Have a conversation about this rather than saying GDP is what it is and we want more of it, period, end of sentence, which is pretty much what we do.
Well, I think, you know, at the root of much of what you write about in the book, which I appreciate very much, is the idea that shareholder capitalism, of course, is not performing like we want, and we need to change it. And to do that, we need to understand it. Yeah. Right? Just a quick story. Probably now 15 years ago, I was having a conversation with somebody in northeast Arkansas. Yeah, this is Walmart territory. You know, it was with the head of HR of a trucking company, transportation company. And it was me and a dean of a business school, the University of Arkansas's business school. And I had this great conversation about what business school students are like. And, you know, we got the usual communication skills need to improve. You know, we'd love to see more teamwork and leadership development. But then we, after the conversation, we got up and started to walk away. And this person said, but wait a minute, there's one other thing. He said, by the way, your students don't understand capitalism, is what he said. Now, he meant it a little bit differently than you did, in the sense that he said, he continued, he said, they don't understand that our job is to make money, period, is what he said. And it occurred to me exactly what you're saying is this fundamental misunderstanding about capitalism. And I really appreciate how you unpack a lot of this, the historical development of capitalism, the theoretical development of capitalism, all of those things, in order to get at the heart of what business schools need to think about and do.
I just want to do it really quickly. You know, what you're bringing up is really important. In my class, Reexamining Capitalism, the first class, I say, students, define capitalism for me. And they struggle. They struggle. And I understand that, but we don't give it enough coverage in a business school. And I find that, again, ironic that they don't understand the system in which one they're going to practice their craft. And the rub is also that they only know one variant of capitalism. Every student in our business school classroom only knows shareholder capitalism. They've never heard of managerial capitalism or preceded it. They don't know the history of its evolution. And so when we're living in a time where Gen Z and millennials are becoming disenfranchised with capitalism, yet they can't define it and they don't understand its history, that's a serious lapse in our educational process. So is the purpose of the firm to make money for the shareholder? They'll parrot it. But what if we go back to Peter Drucker? He said the purpose of the firm is to identify and serve a market. How well it does that is measured in profits, but don't put the cart before the horse. We've put the cart before the horse. And when you do that, you get things like the free fall at Boeing, where they just started to cut, make efficient, and they started making planes that failed. This is what happens. In a damning indictment of the business school degree, when Boeing started to look for a new CEO, the CEO of Emirates, a major customer, said, I don't want to see another MBA in that slot. I want to see an engineer who knows how to build planes. I'll stop there.
Yeah, I think you have many in the audience that do agree with you. I want to generalize this a little bit, though, because we have such an international group at GBSN, and I know that what you've written is applicable around the world. But it's not just the way I think about what you've written is that in business schools, we ought to be questioning whatever system is driving business or shaping business in some ways within the context, right? Mm-hmm. So it may not be shareholder capitalism if you're in South Africa, but some version of capitalism, yeah, that we need to question. And the principles that you've articulated, I think, can be very helpful in all of those contexts. But I want to thank you, Andy. This has been a great, from my point of view, conversation as it relates to how business schools need to think about the future. And I know ultimately the goal is to change the world. And I know that you believe in the power of business schools to do that. And that's, I think, what really matters. That's why we're all here.
And it's really important that this book, I wanted to be a constructive voice, to not just point out the problem, but to also offer my view of solutions with a humble desire to provoke a conversation, not to stand on a soapbox and say, repent, the end is near. That's not my goal.
Well, I think you've succeeded. Yeah. And both in the book and in this conversation. And we want to thank you again for being a part of this, for joining us here today. Yeah.